Continuing my ongoing soul focus reflection series, a reminder that it will take some time to fully unfold how ideas about the soul affect our personal and cultural health. And while I'll recap some key points each Sunday, I can only do so much of that. So recaps will likely get shorter and shorter as we proceed. And of course, it's up to you, but you can always access the audio recordings on the website if you miss any, and or listen again after occasional breaks for other services. As with the next 2 weeks, there'll be different topics. But since we're just starting the series today, I will recap a bit more than will be the norm. In the first installment 2 weeks ago, I described how while the modern era has given humankind immense gifts, its claim that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is beyond the rational, aspect from human life, and thus created what world religion scholar Houston Smith terms an abnormal condition for the human spirit. Because I mention it today, I'll add that I talked about an inner unease and confusion many friends and I experienced as young teenagers as a result of this condition, exemplified by a party treehouse we built wherein we tried to alleviate it with the aid of various substances. I then described why this abnormal condition can no longer be remedied by time-worn religious traditions, which have now become, in Joseph Campbell's words, ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious. Then last week, I introduced Plato's Myth of Ear, E-R, myth here meaning account rather than legend. It's based on what can be loosely called the near-death experience of a wounded soldier named Ear, who witnessed how souls ready to take earthly form are given both the outer conditions, fate, and inner blueprint, destiny, of their mortal experience. I further explained how, as a soul nears its earthly entry, it's joined by a companion spirit net that accompanies and guides it. The Greek name for this being daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, and in Latin, genius. And while the soul forgets its blueprint, the daimon remembers and safeguards the arrangement they and their new human embodiment all share. This keeps the personified soul in touch with its transcendent source and imbues the person with an individual calling and destiny. All of which adds up to a transrational template very different from particularly Judeo-Christian and Islamic doctrines. And I summed it up with four major points that the rest of this reflection series will unfold. Point one, human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling slash destiny. Point two, the most beneficial thing a person can do for oneself and others is to identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible. Point three, people can do this fully with no reference to or reliance on God or any ultimate deity or reality. And point four, this orientation holds the power to heal, inspire, and save lives, and thus help create a better society. This was illustrated with the first of many destiny moment stories you'll hear, relating how Quincy Jones went from wannabe gangster to world-renowned musician and music producer when, in the middle of a youthful petty crime, he walked into a room that held a small piano, walked out again and shut the door, when, quote, something said to me, idiot, go back in that room. I went back in the room and touched the piano, and every drop of blood in my body said, this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And it saved my life. I stressed that while such accounts show the daimon's call most clearly, they only illustrate in sharpest relief what operates in us all, even when less intense or obvious. As archetypal psychologist James Hillman puts it, extraordinary people are not a different category. The workings of this engine in them are simply more transparent. A genius belongs to everyone. Mythologist Michael Mead explains that unlike the current common meaning of genius as exceptional ability, quote, genius and its older form, genie, refer to the spirit that is already there. For Quincy Jones, this is the genie that streamed out of the proverbial bottle when he touched that piano. And the awareness that we have that we too have such a spirit inside provides in Mead's word an instinctive orientation and inherent sense of direction and purpose in one's life. And following from Plato's declaration that what I'm calling this soul focus understanding may preserve us if we are persuaded by it, I proposed that affirming a transcendent purpose and destiny in each person is the soundest root remedy for modernism's abnormal and many times lethal condition of soul-starving spiritual barrenness. So now moving forward from that, and again inviting you to adopt a curious beginner's mind posture, Hillman also seconds Campbell's conviction about traditional religions when he says that comprehending and affirming this transcendent part of ourselves and living life accordingly does not mean that we, quote, therefore bury our heads in the folds of a church, though he does not mean UU churches. He continues, the call to an individual destiny is not an issue between faithless science and unscientific faith. Rather, a soul-focused perspective moves nimbly down the middle between those two old contesting dogmas, barking at each other through the ages. I'll say much more about all of this. But we can approach a pause in these particulars by contrasting an unknown source's remark that, quote, religion is a firm belief in other people's spiritual experience. And we can contrast that with the great 12th century soul poet Rumi's wise counsel, do not be satisfied with the stories that come before you. Unfold your own myth. Yes, yes, and again, yes. For as mythologist Michael Mead affirms, what makes us each unique and therefore genuinely human is more vital than any dogma or doctrine and more creative than any system of belief. So the transcendent more at our core also solidly moors us in meaning, in the deep orienting coherence and creative vitality of our own genius's calling and gifts, which this series will thoroughly describe how to discern and tap into. Both personally and collectively, this is critical. For when such coherence is absent, the abnormal manifestations are diverse and profound. Recalling the deaths of despair statistics I shared 2 weeks ago, poet, potter, and educator M.C. Richards returns us to one cluster of symptoms this absence produces when she writes, there is palpable disunion. The inner soul withdraws, goes underground, splits off from the part that keeps walking around. Psychic disturbance is acute. Suicide may be attempted. And as you recall, one of those statistics I shared was that more than 1 in 5 high school students considered killing themselves in the year before they were surveyed in 2020, 1 or 2. While none of my particular teenage peers attempted suicide, though other people I've known are since dead from drugs and or alcohol, I'm sure this palpable disunion is why we were so lost and so crazed, that is, psychically disturbed. Now much older and a little wiser, I realize our treehouse was an instinctual archetypal attempt to create a ceremonial rite of passage chamber just at the time of life for ritual soul initiations now lost to no-nonsense modern rationalism, but that nonetheless persist in distorted forms like gang initiations and frat hazings. As with all such peer-to-peer efforts, ours was doomed to failure, lacking as it did any spiritual context and content and sage elders to illuminate this for us, because no one, certainly not our Christian ministers, focused as they were on other people's spiritual experiences, spoke to us of calling or soul or purpose or anything of the sort, much less taught us how to spy our diamonds and intimations of destiny as a guide toward fulfilling it. We were seeking what we could not name, but had our elders been able to do so, I have no doubt it would have sounded a deep and calming chord of knowing in us and woken us from the soul ambulatory state Richards describes, walking around but asleep to our souls. Instead, we opted out of life a bit less radically than suicide, merely devouring various inebriants until we were uncomfortably numb and sometimes unconscious, in the vain attempt to bridge this inner split and touch the transcendent more at our core ourselves. And about my earlier wondering of whether other kids also sensed that something was missing and amiss, again, we weren't alone. For as one of Professor Jacob Needleman's high school philosophy course students told him about exploring those central questions of the heart I mentioned, if I had known about this sort of thing, they said, I never would have tried drugs. Obviously, not every experimental or occasional substance use is problematic. And it's in authentic ritual settings, the judicious use of psychedelics has a long history of amplifying soul vision quests. But how many people die drug-related deaths, many driven by despair, every day? How many of their loved ones are racked with anxiety and then too often grief? Add in the violence and terror all along illicit supply chains and the resources spent trying to stem the flood. Weigh up the other costs of intoxicant use and abuse and everything from mother's little helpers to the meth and opioid epidemics, including alcohol's role in many violent crimes and deadly or maiming auto crashes. Again, there are numerous intersecting influences. But Needleman reports that this single comment cemented his resolve to help others explore what he calls a sacred possibility within them. And Mead confirms that when people are, quote, not encouraged or given a chance to awaken to the story seated in their souls, something greater than careers and potentials becomes wasted. Thus, a common flippant phrase of my friends and myself in our sometimes arboreal youth, I'm wasted, actually carries more destructive and sometimes tragic overtones. As does a different acute psychic disturbance resulting from modernism's abnormal condition of spiritual disunion. Because after concurring that one harmful way to cope, quote, is through addictions, which bring about facsimile experiences of self-transcendence followed by craving, cognitive neuroscientist Dusana Dorji also writes that another unhealthy way of satisfying the need for purpose and meaning is through seeking out experiences of dominance and power over others that provide a false sense of self-transcendence. Eminent sociologist Robert Bella develops the disturbing implications by suggesting that if a culture cannot provide enough coherence in and about life to its people, an authoritarian state will likely try to do so. And boy, howdy, aren't we there now? Philosopher and social critic Eric Hoffer underlines this starkly. The feverish desire to band together and coalesce into marching masses is the expression of a desperate effort to escape this ineffectual, purposeless, individual existence. A purposelessness that a soul-starved culture engenders and that a soul focus helps allay, and with it the compensatory drive to domahate. Because as I'll describe further, from neighborhoods to nations, communities are apt to be more peaceable and positive when their residents also inhabit the rich native soil of their souls. Moreover, since we don't come empty into this world, as we learn to recognize the shard of divinity that rode in with us, we also come to see and honor it in others. This allows greater understanding and acceptance, even appreciation of the quirks and preoccupations the diamond's call can force upon its host, including oneself, which are otherwise just inexplicably frustrating. Plus, due to its transcendent nature, Hillman notes that the diamond gives importance to each, not only to the important. An awareness that occasions respect and compassion for oneself and one another. So as we'll get into more on several levels, soul focus is an ethical game changer. None of which implies a flight from life's sometimes arduous demands and distressing actualities. Part of what poet John Keats called soul making is opening more expansively to the world's suffering as well as its beauty. And since the diamond makes its personal demands, attending to its appeals also brings personal tests and trials. Hence, amid the plentiful gratifications, there will often be muddles and miscues, headaches and heartbreaks, slip-ups and slippery slopes. Consequently, the later inclusion of a section on down-to-earth forgiveness is by design. Yet so is the old Greek word for happiness. Eudaimonia, E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A, eudaimonia, with its affirmation that true joy and fulfillment flow from aligning our lives with the diamond's call. Because this call soul-licits us to esteem and engage the transrational more of our lives, not through one-size-fits-all belief, but via customized experience such as that of Quincy Jones's. In the process, it beckons us from existential despair, whether manifest in implosive depressions and self-harm, or explosive power ploys and violence, to an existence infused with significance. And it shines a beacon toward our destiny, which, if we keep faith with its illuminations, leads us to a soulful life, both gratifying and benevolent. All while simply letting the ultimate transrational capital M mystery be mystery. For as Hillman counsels, it seems wiser to attend to the call than to avoid it by searching for its source. Therefore, soul focus, S-O-U-L, is the soul, S-O-L-E, focus required to enjoy these salutary and, regarding assuaging spiritual starvation, salivatory effects. Mead commends this focus more specifically while echoing almost verbatim the questions that so enlivened Needleman's ravenous students. If the tablet of one's being already contains a core pattern and vital shape, then answers to life's burning age-old questions, who am I, and for what purpose was I born, and what should I do with my life, can be found inside the one asking. In this momentous shift from outside-in salvation to inside-out soulvation, from saving one's soul to serving it, and thereby best serving both others and ourselves, soul focus achieves what Campbell terms the modern hero deed of questing to bring to light again the coordinated soul. It therefore contains a prodigious potency to heal and empower self and society. While further talks will expand on all this, I've already touched on the personal benefits a soul-focused understanding supplies. And the close of Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day, reminds us that we do not have forever to apply the resulting gifts. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And even more than individually, the potential benefits are now communal. For as Plato saw, states are as the people are. They grow out of human characters. The more we awaken to the transcendent heart of our own being, the more our hearts spontaneously empathize with others, human and non, and want to see them flourish in every way. And as Mead stresses, in aggregate, this is culturally transformative. He writes, despite the growing confusions and distractions of the modern world, We are the current inheritors of the deep human longings for truth and beauty and the life-sustaining capacity to transform. Transformation at the level of the individual soul generates the imagination and collective energy needed to change the conditions of the world. What we need is not a minor repair, but a major transformation that can only start from the inside. Soul Focus provides a lucid and inspiring map that furthers this win-win transformation. While traversing the terrain isn't always simple or easy, the rewards are sublime and we are in good company. And as one adept companion and guide, Rumi, indicates, the route to take is clear. I have been a seeker and still am, but I stopped asking the books and the stars. I started listening to the teaching of my soul. This ends our introduction. More beginning on February 8th. Namaste and blessed be.